Welcome to the Enabled Disabled Podcast. I'm your host, Gustavo Serafini. I was born with a rare physical disability called PFFD. My journey has been about self-acceptance, persistence, and adaptation. On the show, we'll explore how people experience disability, how the stories we tell ourselves can both enable and disable, how vulnerability is the foundation for strength, and why people with disabilities can contribute more than we imagine. I hope that leaders, companies, clinicians, families, and friends will better understand our capacity to contribute to the world and help enable us to improve it. Elizabeth Jamison is an artist and writer who explores what it means to live in an imperfect body as part of the universal human experience. Before her diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, she served as a public interest lawyer representing incarcerated children, as well as children with chronic illness who were being denied medically necessary care. My talk with Elizabeth was enlightening, interesting, engaging. I think the biggest takeaway that I had is how unbelievably humble she is. She has accomplished so much and has shown such resilience. And yet, when you say that somebody is humble, they're not usually humble like Elizabeth is. She's humble to her core, and you can feel it with the way she answers her questions and the way she views the world. We have an exciting announcement. We recently activated a recording feature on our website where you can ask past guests questions as well as future guests. If we get enough questions for past guests, we'll invite them back to answer your questions. Stay tuned to the newsletter where we'll be previewing future guests and taking your questions ahead of time. Just go to www.enabledisabled.com and press the start recording button to leave your questions. Thanks for listening. See you soon. Elizabeth, it is such a joy to see you again. Thank you so much for being on the show. I'm really excited to have you here.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you, Gustavo.
You're welcome. So I would like to really take this time with you to celebrate who you are as a person, all the amazing work that you've done, and share with the audience your joy, your passion for work, all of the energy that you still have, and what you're trying to do to make the world a little bit of a better place. So I think you have a very powerful story with it. Kind of started from, you were an attorney previously, and you defended children who were incarcerated, and then children who had disabilities or chronic conditions that needed medical care. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to that kind of work and why, you know, you were moved to go into that space?
Yeah, I'll try. Ever since I was young, I knew I wanted to change the world. And I had a dream as a little girl of ending the world of hunger. And I personally was going to feed the entire world. I thought I could do it. And I thought maybe I could also bring about world peace. That's how arrogant I was. But I was young and I was ambitious, and I thought, well, why can't I make the world a better place? And let's start with ending all war. So that's how I was young, and I knew that I want to have meaning, that my life would have to have meaning for other people. And I don't know why I always had that mission in my mind. And personally, I'm Catholic. I wanted to be a nun. until I discovered I couldn't get married and I had crushes on boys. So that desire being none quickly evaporated in junior high, but the mission never escaped my mind.
And the mission there is the most important thing. So I know that obviously you can probably tell us a whole bunch of depressing or, you know, sobering facts and experiences from your time as a lawyer. But if we dig in a little deeper, what did you learn from that experience? What was your takeaway of why the work you were doing mattered so much, how you were making a difference, or maybe something that you learned about people that you weren't expecting to know?
I loved my work. I was a civil rights lawyer, and I started out in jails and prisons. First job was in adult prisons. And I loved my clients. I didn't know them intimately, but I so was appalled by the conditions in which they were confined in. And I thought, that's not being human. We're treating people like dogs. And I went from doing adults, then I went to involving children who were in jails and prisons and juvenile halls. And I spent many years traveling in the country, investigating how kids were being treated, incarcerated. And that was so black and white. There was no gray. It was just so meaningful and wonderful. I mean, every day was so great because we could really help people and use the law as a way of helping kids who really, really needed help. So it was great. And I, at that time, before my diagnosis, I was doing civil rights law where everything was black and white. There were people in need of help, and I was a lawyer. I was going to help them. It was when I stopped being a lawyer and became an artist, I discovered gray. And I now think life is much more full of gray and shades of gray and not just black and white. And that's maturity and how I've learned through aging the nuances of living with gray.
That's really interesting. So when the world was more black and white for you, you were coming from the perspective of I'm right. Like I know that I'm trying to do good, and I know that these people are being mistreated, and I'm going to fix it. Is that correct?
Yes. And I still feel that way. And there's so much black and white, and we can do so much with the horrible injustices that we need to stand up and be accounted for. And so I believe in black and white, but I also think there's also lots of grays and subtleties of gray. And that's what I've been dealing with in terms of disability, because there's a lot of subtlety in terms of how we live in life and how people treat us as someone with a disability.
Before we shift into the really interesting grays, I want to just ask you for the disability activists out there, for the attorneys out there who are doing this great social work. What was the most powerful tool that you used as an attorney to help
make change, to help, you know, make an impact in these people's lives?
Well, one of my favorite clients was Alexander Singh. He was born with a genetic disability, and he had a trach. He still has a trach, and we're still wonderful friends. He was 6 months old when I first represented him because his insurance company refused to pay for nursing care in order to keep him alive on a tracheotomy. And we sued, and it's not just me. There was a group of people in there. It was a group effort. We sued the insurance company because the insurance company said that he would only allow 30 days of in-home nursing care. And the remainder of nursing care is to be provided by the mother. And of course, the mother works, and she had her insurance covered because she was working. If she quit her job, there went her health insurance. So that's what the insurance company, I think, wanted, is to, you know, have her insurance company dropped so they didn't have to face reimbursing the nursing care. And so she hired me and my organization, as well as other lawyers who joined me pro bono. And we sued the insurance company on behalf of all children in California who had tracheotomies. And we were successful in allowing all people with tracheotomies to have all the medical care that was medically necessary. It turns out about near 24 hours a day nursing care. So it was so thrilling and exciting. And despite the fact that people thought that Alexander would die because he's severely disabled, he's thriving, he's a writer, and he's my son's age, and he's growing up to be an absolutely gorgeous young man, and he's my great friend. And here I'm disabled. I'm a quadriplegic, and now I can call and talk to Alexander about, oh God, it's so awful being a quad. He just laughs out loud and thinks, what do you know about it? I've been having this disability since my life. Oh, Elizabeth, get used to it. So he laughs and we have a good time. And I would have thought life would have been, I was his lawyer in the courtroom, and now he's my buddy. And it's amazing what happens in life. We're both equal, truly equal. And he's the one who's has the knowledge and wisdom, not me. So I love that lesson of life just comes and delivers whatever it wants to you. And we have to be joyous and welcome whatever mess is delivered. Life is messy, and the shit show, we just have to deal with the messy lives we all live.
That is very well said, and that's such a powerful story in so many ways. So can you tell us a little bit about when you were diagnosed with MS, what was your adjustment process like? What was that messy, interesting? Like, what did you struggle with? some of the things that you learned from it? And let's dive deeper into all of those things, because I love how open you are to acknowledge the mess and to acknowledge how messy life is, but also to find a way to embrace it and find joy in it and learn from it.
I'm looking at you and laughing because when I first talked with you, I thought, oh, how could I not be joyous talking to you? Because you're having this big, huge grin, smile at me. And I feel like, oh, I meet the most wonderful people. So I'm really glad to be staring at you and looking at your wonderful smile. And well, in answer to your question, what was the question? Well, when I was first diagnosed with MS, I was healthy, athletic. I wasn't sick. I was a badass lawyer, or so I thought, in my youthful arrogance. And I ended up at the MS clinic. I started having all sorts of symptoms. And I thought, oh my God, there are two people in the waiting room in wheelchairs. I thought, I'm not going to be in a wheelchair. And I didn't even want to look at the people in wheelchairs. That's how, just not dismissive, but it was so scary to me to see people in wheelchairs. Because I was not going to be in a wheelchair. Well, guess what? Now I'm in a wheelchair and I'm a quadriplegic. I have no use of any part of my body, really. I'm paralyzed basically from the neck down. And it's been slow, slow loss and loss and loss, like dripping loss. So I got to really the slowness in terms of how much progression I've had has allowed me to adjust loss to loss. I went from being a lawyer, and then I went, oh, shit, what am I going to do? Because I loved being a public interest lawyer. That was my mission. And when I could no longer practice law, that it was devastating for me, because that's how I define myself, rightly or wrongly, was a change maker. And when I ended up realizing I could no longer practice law with my disabilities, I stumbled upon art by happenstance. I've never been an artist, never owned paintbrushes, really never desired at all to be an artist. And I discovered from a small art class that I loved it, and I kept pursuing it. Ended up going to a university. And I enrolled in many art classes, and I ended up becoming an artist. And when I was a young artist, I was pretty successful in terms of, when I say successful, meaning I was able to sell my work. And I got really bored. I thought, well, I can do wonderful still life paintings and portraiture. I love doing it, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a public interest artist. If I couldn't be a public interest lawyer, well, I'm going to be a public interest artist. Whatever that means. I don't know what that meant, but I went around to the ACLU another organization and said, can I do some artwork for you for free? And let me see what would that look like? And I talked to the heads of various nonprofits, and they were all thrilled to give me assignments. And I, one nonprofit asked me to do a series of portraits of famous inspirational women. And I thought, my God, I can do public interest art. And after I did a stint working for other organizations, I decided, you know what, this doesn't make sense. I want to do something for my people, which is MS. So I knew what I wanted to do, and that was to do something with my MRIs. MRIs are neurological tests that most people who have the luxury of great health care, we get MRIs to track the progression of our disease. And I've had many, many, many MRIs. And to me, they were ugly, depressing, scary images of the brain. And I didn't want to look at them. I didn't want to acknowledge, didn't want to stare at them for sure. And I decided as an artist, I have to do something about these images. Because that, to me, was a symbol of MS, was the MRI. Because even people who had minor symptoms and those who have great symptoms, like myself, we still all have the common denominator of the MRI. And so I spent about 3-4 years trying to figure out, how in the world can I make art out of neurological testing, medical data? And I finally discovered the technique of etchings. And I etched my brain, my MRIs of my brain. And then I went to town and colored these etchings of my brain on copper prints. And I developed in the sun the solar etchings of my brain and then colorized them. And that's what I've done for 4 or 5 years. And I was really so excited to take medical imaging and make them not only in the scientists or medical persons' realm. I want to take it into the patient's world. I want to control my data. And I thought all of us should be able, if we want, to control our data and color it whatever color we want. When I say color it, just take ownership of your MRIs, our MRIs. And so I've done colors, darker colors, lighter colors, and a lot of gold. Because to me, the MRI is the most sacred parts of the brain, sacred parts of the body, because the brain is the locus of our personality. So that's, I thought, that is a public interest artist. They can do something maybe for people with MS and for scientists to really understand that. And maybe they already do, but I want to reemphasize, encourage them to take a new look at the humanity of the brain. And A lot of neuroscientists have really enjoyed what I've done, were fascinated how you can gain a different perspective if you colorize the brain. So that's what I've done.
You've done more than that, but we're gonna get into. But so this whole idea of taking control of your data and taking control of and colorizing and reimagining or looking at yourself in new ways. I was born with my disability, and I know that for many years, maybe in some sense, I still do, it depends on the day, but I never liked mirrors. I never liked looking at myself in the mirror. I never liked seeing myself on video because it was a reminder of a part of me that I didn't always want to be reminded of. How did taking these MRI scans and images help you, or, you know, help you better be more friendly with yourself, to embrace your life situation, to take control of it? You know, how did a perspective shift, not with the artwork, on how you saw your own disability and your own condition?
That's a great question, and one that I think about a lot, because it made me love the brain, and I'm fascinated by the brain. I keep reading more and more books about neuroscience and the brain. I met many neuroscientists since I began this endeavor. It makes me really form a real relationship with my disease. And I talked to you a little bit about it. It's my new desire to understand how I feel about multiple sclerosis. So I have huge lesions in my brain, and you can see them in my MRI. Instead of feeling ugly, and I don't want to look these holes in my brain, but the fact that one radiologist said in the radiology report, this person either has Alzheimer's or multiple sclerosis, her brain is shrunken, small, really small. And I was terrified when I read that. And now my neurologist said, really doesn't mean much. It depends what you do, not so much what the report says. So now I think, God, how fascinating what these holes, these images portray. I'm really interested in the brain. And I'm starting to really respect my disease. What a weird, complicated, powerful, fascinating friend, an enemy, friend, enemy, whatever that term is. Like, I just so respect my disease. I'm in awe of it. I hate it. I love it. It's a really intimate relationship. With all intimate relationships, it's filled with the good, the bad, the ugly. And I really, that's my mental focus now, is trying to develop a strong, intimate relationship of kindness and compassion for my disease. Because it's progressive, and I want to love my disease if it means I can hate it too, because there are times when it really pisses me off. And I don't like I feel like, give me a break. But I want to really, sort of like how I feel about my husband. I adore him, but sometimes it gets me really mad, angry, as all good relationships are like. And I just want that type of intimate relationship with my disease. I don't want to hate my disease. And I feel that my artwork has really given me a deep perspective. I'm not sure other people would have that journey, but for me, it's so interesting and it's sacred. And images, I've talked with other people with spinal cord injury, and I've worked with their MRIs, and their MRIs of the bone. I don't have one of the bone, but MRIs of the bone are fascinating, and it gives me incredible love or real interest in other people's MRIs. I don't know, I think it's really informed how I want to deal with my disease. And when my disease progressed to my arms and shoulders and fingers, so I could no longer be an artist, I decided, well, what am I going to do? And I decided the only thing I can do, I think, is write. So I've been writing a lot since I could no longer still be an artist. And boy, I was so devastated when I couldn't practice law. And then I was unbelievably devastated that I couldn't do art anymore when I started to be really competent with my art tools and my skills. So now I'm writing, but with such pain. It's really hard being a writer. I think it's the hardest skill in the world. And so that's what I'm doing. Just doing that what I can. And I want to really come to grips with my MS, the words. And to show why disability matters and why we have to come to get, I should think we have to. It would be nice if one can really experience disability as part of being human. We're all human beings who are messy and imperfect lives, but we all are imperfect in one way or another. And if we could all really understand it, I think would the idea of disability as being some weird status which needs laws to protect dignity and to recognize the beauty of disability. And I just think we can maybe do that if we learn more about our lives. Like, I'd like to know more about your life, Gustavo. I think it's all so fascinating.
I love that perspective so much, Elizabeth, and I think It is not something that I came at it from a different approach, but I love this idea of being kinder to ourselves, of taking whatever it is that we're going through, whether it's loss, whether it's a disability, whatever it is in our lives, and being open enough to try to understand it, to approach it from a friendly perspective and say, hey, look, my disability is a part of me. Why don't I want to become friends with that intimate, vulnerable, messy part of myself? It helps me understand myself better, helps me understand other people better, right? And it helps us, the fear that so many people have of aging, of what we're going to lose, you know, of what we're going to be, what's going to be taken away from us. You've flipped the script on that and said, well, what can I do? What can I contribute? What can I learn? So I'm amazed that, you know, your curiosity, your ability to deal with a loss and make further gains from it. I know it's hard, but it's remarkable too, because you could have given up, you could have stopped, you could have become bitter, but you didn't. You chose another path. And I think that merits, that's something that we should celebrate. That's something that we should, you know, amplify. And how, like, I know a lot of that is from your own personality, but what were some of the things, the anchors or the places that you went to in yourself that we can help other people go to when they're struggling as well?
Thank you for all your kind words. I think I'm going to duck that question because I feel so blessed that I've had the income level to afford great medical care. I've been through so many wheelchairs as my disease progressed, and I have great cushions. So my butt sits on a great cushion. Well, you have to have money to have a good cushion on your wheelchair. And you have to have cash, because insurance probably was not going to pay for that good cushion. And Medicare does not pay for that great cushion. And if I didn't have the great cushion, I couldn't write. I couldn't do artwork because I would be in pain. And I feel so blessed that I've been so lucky that I've been able to be ambitious. So I don't know if I'm ducking your questions, but I'm just so aware of how blessed I have been to have good medical care and good equipment in order to fulfill my ambitions. And I'm so ambitious now. Even though I'm getting more and more disabled, I feel like, all right, what can I do now? How can I give back? And I'm really aware of the luck. My disease hasn't progressed to such that I can't talk anymore. That's my next vulnerability, is I'm starting to lose some of my ability to speak. And that terrifies me. I think I won't be a nice, wonderful Susie Sunshine if my voice is taken from me. My diaphragm is getting weaker and weaker, and you have to have a good diaphragm in order to produce voice. So I don't want to portray a picture that anyone with a MS can be an artist or a writer. I mean, anyone who has really good luck and really has the money to have good health insurance, maybe they can. But I'm so lucky. I'm aware of my good fortune and luck, and I'm in awe of how lucky I am. And I love my life. And that's because of luck, or I don't know why I'm blessed to still be able to kick ass. I still want to kick ass. I but with a lot of humility and with recognition how fortunate I am.
I respect that a lot. I don't think you're ducking the question, Elizabeth, but I think there are so many people who are lucky in a similar way. There are so many people who have had so many opportunities and who don't have the character or the desire to kick ass like you and to give back like you and to try to help people and understand yourself. So I would like to give you, I respect your humility tremendously, but I would like to give you, you know, some real important credit there. Like, you didn't have to do those things. You still, with all of your fortune and all of your, the work that you did, you still could have been, you still could have made different choices. And so maybe, you know, let's reframe the question a little bit. So how can we help other people understand the things that are needed for people with disabilities to be able to be put into a position to make those contributions, to give back, to still be productive and have meaningful connections in their lives? Like, what are the things that you wish more people understood?
God, can I dig that one up, that question? I don't want to duck of it. Well, one thing I need so much, and I think a lot of people that must need, is community. And maybe as a community, we can inspire each other. And maybe we can think of ways to make people unafraid of us. I am really scary. I have a huge wheelchair and I don't have the use of hands. So, and my voice sometimes works great. Other times it's really scratchy. And people oftentimes think I'm intellectually impaired because I don't talk loud and I look weird and people are terrified of me. And I think one thing, a thing I could do is just be in a shopping center and so people could see me and say, I'm nice, I'm not scary, I would probably really like you. And if I didn't like your political beliefs, we could have a great discussion about politics. And I think people are frightened by disability. I know I was, until I became disabled. I think I was tricking your question. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I will. You're not ducking it. You're just so humble. And I know that, like, none of us are Susie Sunshines all the time. And yeah, I don't know. Like, when I met you, I think within, I don't know, 30 seconds, you're not scary. You know, I'm so looking forward to meeting you. Like, you're so warm, interesting, intelligent. Like, your curiosity is through the roof, you know, and I can't help but feel, you know, connected to you. I want to get to know you better as well. So, Maybe that's the trick, is how can we develop or build communities so that other people don't have to fear us, that they don't look at us as that one dimensionality of, like, you know, oh, I see that person who has a disability and that represents loss. They're not taking the time to see everything that we've gained and everything that we've learned because of that. Yeah. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, we have so much to learn. I mean, I've learned so much from my clients and learned so much about disability from other people who are disabled. And because I wasn't disabled, I never met people like you when I was practicing law. I didn't know how to be. I would be scared to talk to you because I didn't know what would the language be. Now I say, talk to me whenever you want to talk to me. Just don't swear too loudly. You could swear, but don't say the worst swear words. But I mean, you don't know unless you're introduced to the lives of the disabled. So cultural competency or cultural curiosity of people who live with disabilities is really important, I think. Important for employers who are scared of us. They're scared of, oh my God, what about insurance? I don't want to get sued by them. They probably aren't intelligent. And all the stereotypes that come up, which I probably had too, because I'm not blaming people, but we all need to be culturally curious. To us as disabled person, because disability means 1,000 things. There's so many types of cancer. There's so many autoimmune diseases. There's so many genetic disabilities. It's all so fascinating and things to be curious about. I think if employers knew that, I know your mission is employment-based mission is to know, to be educated about how many brilliant people with disabilities there are, and that could really make your company thrive and be innovative. But they have to know us, or they have to be willing be curious. They're not curious. They're not going to give us the opportunity to work for us. So
that is so true. Curiosity and open-mindedness are tremendously important. Before I met you, I saw you in the Unfixed series with Kimberly. Kimberly's been on the show, Kimberly Warner. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like and what you learned by being on that show? And I know you're also doing other projects with her. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like, what you've learned, what you'd like to keep doing in that direction?
Along the lines, what we were just talking about, Kimberly has produced a podcast for a film series of people of all sorts of disabilities, where we answer various questions of the month. And I've learned so much. Like, I didn't know so much about traumatic brain injury. I've heard of it. I thought I knew what it was about, but not until I saw such wonderful people who had traumatic brain injury did I have any understanding the nuances involved in that trauma. And there's a man I really fell in love with was ALS, and I've seen the progression of his ALS. He can't talk, has no ability to eat, or it seems so horrifying, absolutely horrifying to me. And I've been occasionally emailing him. He's thoroughly so brilliant and at peace with his disability. And now I don't know whether it's at peace at times and arguing with his disease, and he's swearing at his disease. But basically, he's at peace. And I'm like, oh my God, something was so, I can't imagine more disabled person in the world is a person can't do anything for himself. And he can blink. That's about it. And he's, I think, loves life. I don't want to speak for him, but he's very elegant, beautiful young man. And I've never talked with anyone with ALS. And there's so many diseases, disabilities in that video series. I learned so much humility and awe. I've been awed by these people, like, oh my God, every month. I can't wait to hear their answer these questions. So what I learned was how much I need to learn. And it's really not a painful process. That's like, this is great. And there's a woman who just published a book called Between Two Kingdoms. And it's a woman who suffered from leukemia, and she had a bone marrow transplant. And I bought the book because her lover, Jean Baptiste, he's my favorite musician in the world. I figured, well, if Jean Baptiste likes her, I'm going to read the book. And I learned so much from her experience with having a bone marrow transplant. And otherwise, if I didn't have that curiosity of how did Jean Baptiste fall in love with her, because I want him to fall in love with me. So I have to say, I was just awestruck by the beauty of her writing and her whole personality.
It's amazing how so much of what we need as people, right, is to love and be loved, and how complicated that can become when either we have a disability or a chronic condition or something, right, that most people look at and say, kind of push you away a little bit, and not, we lose some of that ability. And yet what you said is, it just feels like that, you know, your journey has been reminding yourself or relearning, right? Being curious and remembering that, yes, you are capable of love and being loved, and you're still that kind, generous, curious, amazing human being. So that's my impression of it. And that's, do you think that has some validity, what I'm saying?
Well, it's something I work on a lot is self-love. Because part of me, I don't like looking myself in the mirror. I have to really practice self-compassion to realize that I'm worth it, that I have some value. Like, even though externally I know I've accomplished amazing things, I worry about how much burden I've brought on to my family and my husband. I feel like I'm a burden a lot. You know, it's every day, not every day, but I try to work on self-compassion a lot. I think maybe we all do, especially those of us in the disabled community, because I don't know, we're not perfect, and we have to love being imperfect and human. And our society is not based on the beauty of imperfection. It's based on perfection and Instagram photos and the idea of the perfect life, perfect spouse, perfect child, etc. And we all, I think, we all, I think we have to do anything, but oh, it would be nice if we could all love it, love ourselves. And I think if disabled bodies are really imperfect by any standard, and I think we have to, I know I need to really work on self-compassion a lot.
We all do. I agree with you, and it's, I think the illusion of perfection is the fact that so many people embrace that. It just makes it, it makes it that much more difficult and that much more traumatic when those illusions break down, and they will at some point or another, they will break down for everybody. And on the flip side, it's so important to see the beauty in ourselves and to see, embrace our imperfections. Like, we have so much to teach each other and so much to learn from each other. I hadn't thought of it in quite that way before. So thank you for that. Is there something, Elizabeth, that you think I've missed in the discussion that is really important to talk about?
Yeah, one thing, and I don't know how to talk about it, but one thing I know, what I want to do is really chronicle the joys I have in my life, because oftentimes we don't know, we washes through us, but there, I try to have recognition of joy and just small things. One is my peanut butter. I love peanut butter. And I got through COVID by having a bunch of peanut butter with my apples every morning and lots of espresso. And it's just small things. And the fact I've articulated peanut butter, it really makes me happy. It does bring me joy, and I don't think it would if I hadn't really thought about what's the things that really get me happy. And songs like by John Baptiste bring me so much joy. And I'm now dancing to some of John Baptiste's music, and I can't move my body. But I move my head. I have gray head moves. It's just weird white head moves, white women head moves. But they're really, I'll go and on any dance floor and be wheeled down to the middle of the dance floor and dance with my neck. But I just joy. And maybe we have unbelievable amount of joy that should be on our resumes. A resume. Oh, I'm Alyssa Jameson, I have lots of joy. Now, please hire me, whatever silly thing I'm coming up with right now. But
it's true, though. We have to, I hope that one day we can dance to some music together and we can maybe even put it on film just so people can see what all the different ways we can experience joys with different bodies and different personalities and, you know, just express all of those things that we feel that we can't really put into words.
Really? And one thing, I love the artists that we've all worked with, like Kimberly. She's an unbelievable woman who's really taking film to a new level in terms of recognizing what it means to be disabled. All the conversations that she has ignited through her video productions. So I really want to give a plug to Kimberly Warner. She's just an amazing woman.
I couldn't agree more. I'm so happy that I met her. I'm looking forward to, I love her work. You're right. She's her and her partner, goodness, her name is escaping me, but the other person she works with on the films, do you know her name? No. Okay. Well, they have such a sensitivity and such an eye for how to bring us closer and connect us with all of those parts of our humanity that most people don't want to look at. And it's like it invites you in rather than it's intimate, it's warm, it's friendly, but it's also like it doesn't, like you said before, it doesn't hide the ugly, it doesn't hide the messy, but it's humanizing. And it just brings me in. When I first started watching the series, I couldn't stop watching it. I think I just watched it all the way through. It was so compelling.
Yeah, the warmth and compassion is incredible. She's really a gift to all of us. So I want to give her my money to do more and more work.
Me too. So Elizabeth, how can people learn more about you, connect with you, ask you questions?
Well, I have a website. I have an email. I have Instagram. God, I have all the social media, but some of it I don't really use because I don't really know how without hands. It's hard for me to have access to things, but I'm on my email 24 hours a day, ejameson@ God.
We can always put that in the show notes, but is it ejamesonfineart@gmail.com?
Yes.
Okay.
God, I'm totally embarrassed.
That's fine. And your website is jamesonfineart.com?
You got it.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I'm nervous being interviewed by such a famous, handsome, lovely, warm human being.
Thank you so much. And I'm not, fame is not part of the equation. So, but thank you for saying that. I think you are, it's just, I think you're incredible. I'm so happy we met. I'm so happy you're on the show. I hope we can do this again. And I'm really looking forward to meeting you soon.
Absolutely. Fort Lauderdale, here we come.
That's right. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Bye.